Welcome to viewers to episode 6 of Valhalla Conversations, where I, my self-confessed Viking obsessive Norse mythology geek, interview my favourite Norse creatives. And one of my special guests today, I'm delighted to announce, is Tessa Grattan, one of my favourite authors of the United States of Asgard series. Here are her lovely books, just peeking up behind me, all four, an anthology of short stories as well. So yes, do go buy them, borrow them, download them, listen to them on audio podcast. I also have done that, and it's equally still as good as reading the book. So I've invited Tessa here to talk about her wonderful books, United States of Asgard, and I guess I'll hand it over to you, Tessa, because if someone's just heard that name, United States of Asgard, yep, Asgard, not America people, Asgard, how would you explain the universe that you encapsulate so well in your books to new potential readers?
Sure, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here talking about this series. It's been a long time since I've focused on it, so hopefully I'll remember everything accurately. The United States of Asgard is an alternate America, an alternate history where when the Vikings first came to North America, and landed on Newfoundland, they stayed instead of leaving again. And so it was Vikings and their gods and monsters, who are very real because this is a fantasy. They are the ones who essentially conquered and colonized North America. So that's the initial world pitch, I guess. And the first book follows a young man who's 17. His name is Soren, and he is a berserker, and he does not want to be because his father was also a berserker. And when Soren was about 10 years old, his father lost control of his berserking frenzy in a shopping mall and killed 13 or so innocent people. And so Soren really fights the frenzy that he feels, and he does not trust Odin, who is supposed to be the god he's dedicated to.
Well, if that hasn't hooked in, dear viewers and dear readers, I don't know what will. Hopefully the rest of this episode will indeed convert you all, because I personally, having read this as it was like some years ago when I first read this, in fact Facebook reminded me yesterday that yesterday was the day I ordered it on Amazon. So that's how long ago it was. It's now a Facebook memory, but it's always been on my shelf of favourites, always has been. But it's a world that I find so rich, so incredibly deep. I think I once described to a friend as, if you know how deep the world is for Lord of the Rings, this is how deep Tessa's gone with the world of the United States of Asgard, because it's so believable. It's so normal, yet not normal, but not in a startling, mind-bogglingly alien way. For example, the gods are real. You've got actually them kind of working in collaboration of sorts with the humans. I know when I reread both The Lost Son, which is the first book about Sorin, and the second book, The Strange Maid, which is my personal favourite because it's got Valkyries in it, and that's like my catnip. I mentioned the word Valkyries and I'll go for it, which is about Signy. You've kind of got how... I can't remember which president it was. I think it began with a Thomas Jefferson, maybe not Thomas Jefferson, but he had like almost like a riddle contest with Odin. And that's how the gods ultimately lost their overwhelming power, because the gods actually lost a riddle match to a human. And that's why they worked together.
Right.
There's just so many aspects to your world. And I guess my first question is, where did these ideas come from? How did you decide to rewrite history effectively and remake the world in this most wonderful way?
It is both really, of course, like long and complicated, and also very, very simple. And so I'll tell you the simple version first. Mm-hmm. It was when I was in graduate school, so I was 24-ish, and I was really, really angry all the time. I'm still a very angry person. I like to argue. But this was it was 2004, 2005. And so it was really in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 and the Iraq War. And the 2004 election, which was when George W. Bush was reelected, and it was really awful. you know, for its own really specific reasons. And I was in graduate school studying public policy and gender. I was trying to write a thesis about the way the culture wars in America were influencing policy, particularly from a gendered lens and about like sexuality. And I was just so angry. And also, I'm the kind of person who, you know, when people say, well, when you go to dinner with strangers or friends, the two things you should never talk about are religion and politics. But those are the only things I ever wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. And so I was just thinking about when I started writing books, I was thinking about how do I write a book about America, about the religion and politics and the way those things in America are so fundamentally linked, even though we pretend that they're not, without people being angry at me all the time. Like, I can't criticize, you know, Jesus, but you know who I can criticize? Balder. you know, like I basically came up with this idea to write and talk about the kinds of things that I wanted to analyze in America from a fantastical point of view. And that is the, like, that is what made me start down the road. So that's the simple, I know I just talked for like 4 minutes and that's simple.
That's fine. It's really interesting.
At the same time in graduate school, I was very unhappy with the program that I was in. And I was really frustrated with not being able to find mentors who were interested in the aspects of gender studies and feminism, really, that I was interested in writing about and studying. And I hit this point where I was like, I need to take some classes that have nothing to do with my degree. And so I looked at what they offered, like what random things do they offer here that I'm interested in? And I found a professor who was teaching Old English.
Ooh.
And I could take three trimesters. We were on a trimester system there. The first two were learning the ins and outs of the language and learning how to translate. And then the third trimester was focused just on translating Beowulf. And I was like, this is it. This is the most like niche English thing I can think of to do that they offer here. And so while all of this was going on, while I was being really angry at politics and trying to figure out my life and what to write about, I was learning how to translate and read Old English, and then did a real deep dive into Beowulf itself. And that really led me down the path that would eventually bring me to Norse mythology and the history of how the cultures of, you know, the Norse cultures really influenced the UK and then into America. And I mean, you can really straight line from the war culture of the ancient Norse to the war culture of 2005 United States of America. And the things that the poetry really highlights are things that I was seeing the politicians in the news highlighting, you know, the way that they talk about fallen warriors and warriors going across the sea to fight somewhere else were directly reflected in these, you know, 1600 year old poems. So it really was, it seemed very obvious to me at a certain point that I could write about America on every level from a fantastical, like Viking alternate youth history perspective. So it was very organic in a lot of ways.
Well, that sounds like a remarkable opportunity. And I know from rereading Strange Maid about Signy, the young want to be Valkyrie who gets, I keep saying that word wrong, Valkyrie, not Valkyrie. I've always pronounced the I more than the E, and I know that's wrong, but it's just a habit I need to learn, dislearn. But she gets given basically a prophecy, supposedly by Odin, left on the World Tree where she first meets him when she's grieving for the loss of her parents. And they have a strange connection almost, and he challenges her to become the ninth Valkyrie of the tree because there hasn't been one for some time. And it's really only as you learn through the books, learn the amazing history that you've given, this amazing present, alternative present day world that you've given, where the Valkyries have been involved in all sorts, including like the civil war over the influence of slavery. And I thought it was really interesting how when you learn about that through the characters, they say it's like, it's Odin wanting to keep the old ways. It was Thor and this one renegade of sorts, Valkyrie, who wanted to say that, no, we just can't keep keeping them as slaves. It's just kind of like wrong. Because of course I'm working on a very secret project. I can't quite tell you all yet, dear viewers. Tessa and one, maybe two other, three people. No, very small circle, but I'm waiting for it to be more officially confirmed. But it is closely linked to that particular book, and I'm not going to say why. But even though I thought I was looking for one thing in your book, the Beowulf theme kept coming through more and more clear. And of course, you do seem to almost reenact it within that alternative context, which of course I love, because I've never studied Beowulf. I remember seeing the Beowulf CGI film with Angelina Jolie and the other British guy that I can't remember the name of, that he's in all the films. That's the only kind of like version I know, and even that gave me nightmares because their version of Grendel was so grotesque, it was just, oh, it just put me right off. But that I know the basics of the story, although there was the lady that you tend to pick upon through the character of Signy in that book. It begins with a V, and you're going to have to pronounce it for me if you can remember, Tessa, because I want to say Velathal, but I'm not sure if that's it.
That is how I changed it for the book. That would be an older version of it. Her name in Beowulf is Walkthal, and it's W-E-A-L, then the, I think the thorn. But so it's the old English version. So her name in English actually starts with a W, which is very common when you see the transition from the Icelandic languages in when it becomes English. I can't remember what the transition is called. But Welchthal is her name, is the wife of King Hrothgar in Beowulf. And so that is the character that I played with the history for The Strange Maid. And it is Valfiel in the book, my book.
Yes, it's certainly more pronounceable versus Woe. It certainly makes sense when you think about kind of how the Anglo-Saxons called it all Wodan instead of Odin. But yes, that makes sense. But yes, and that particular book, of course, Signy is given this challenge. He's got to fulfill this prophecy, but it's also a bit of a riddle at the same time. And she really struggles with it. She ends up on a down, and then she comes across a character called Ned the Restless, I want to say. I can't quite remember the...
Spiritless,
that was it. Sorry. It's been a while. I have read it, dear viewers. I have. It's just been a few weeks since. And as I'm a mum, my memory is shot. All I can remember is toddler things and not anything else. But yes, I liked his character simply because it was almost like a nice homage to the work and efforts of the Skalds of that era and the work that they did, capturing these stories and telling them to audiences, as well as kind of like honorific poetry for kings and queens and great warriors and the like. And of course, who knows what Skalds told Beowulf back in the day, because also no one knows who wrote Beowulf, which is the greatest mysteries of our time, I think. But I really liked it. And of course, Sauron does actually make a return from book one into book two, and of course book three, which is the Apple Throne, which is about the other character which we haven't yet mentioned, which does also feature in the first one. So there's a nice flow of characters from one to the other, dear readers. You don't always have to know them all. It's Astrid, and she herself has quite an amazing backstory as a vulva, as a seeress, or being the daughter of one who then mysteriously vanishes. And I'm trying not to spoil it here, but at some point the goddess Freya gets involved. Now, this is the one thing I remember picking up with you way back in the day when I first read it, was how you've adapted Freya to also kind of represent the goddess Hel as well, because you've got a good number of the key gods in there, but of course there's quite a broad pantheon. Yes. Pantheon. But I found your version of Freya quite interesting and almost refreshing in that she has got this darkness to her, from not just kind of like being the goddess of the dead to a degree, but of what she can do and influence and foresee that Odin can't. So how did you kind of address or create that wonderful balance or imbalance of gods and goddesses?
Keeping in mind that I did most of this world building work at least 15 years ago.
Yes, that's fine. That's fine. Don't worry. We're all forgiving.
The Lost Sun came out in 2011. In 2013. Mm-hmm. And so the bulk of the work that I was doing developing the world was probably between like 2008 and 2013. So I did a real, like, several years of slow deep dive into the history and archaeology of like Norse mythology. So I read everything I could get my hands on, of course, the epic poems and everything that was written by Snorri
Sturluson.
Yes.
That's the one name I can only remember because it starts with S and ends with S.
So I read all of these translations, you know, everything I could get my hands on. And I also read a bunch of archaeological books by people who have actually, like, you know, gone and looked at, okay, here's what we actually think the culture was like, and here's how we can trace, like, the first time we think Odin was mentioned on a runestone, and how old these different gods seem to be. And from what I remember, Snorri Sturluson basically made up 80% of what we think of as Norse mythology. And of course, he didn't pull it out of nowhere. There were would definitely have been lots of stories and things, but he consolidated most of the big epic stories, and he's the one who is like, Odin is the Allfather and Loki is a guy and things like that. And, like, if you go back, you know, 1,000 years before he was alive, there was there were some theories that Odin and Loki were actually the same trickster god figure. And that there was a goddess of the underworld who was also a god of fate, who became Freya, you know, as these things were developing. And of course, there's no way to really trace it because it was an oral culture. And, you know, what we have written down before Snorri came along are, you know, death monuments and good luck charms and funeral rites, you know, things like that. And so, you know, it's really hard to accurately say, well, this is how this god developed and these are how these stories developed. So it was really very easy to come in and be like, well, this is what I want. And it could be true. This could be how these gods developed. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm going to do. And I think Hel, the character, the goddess was a very late addition to the pantheon, from what I remember of my research. And so it, you know, there would have, Freya was a much older character. And so that was the basis of why I ultimately did that. And also because she's connected to, you know, half of the dead. You know, she gets a bunch of warriors in the more popular mythology.
Yes, that's all I've ever read, is that not only is she not of the Azir, which Odin is, but she's also of the Vanir, which is possibly some kind of ancient tribe that there's a war and they just happen to get swapped in a prisoner of war kind of swap exchange or hostage exchange. But of course, the Azir got the wrong end of the bargain because they sent Mimir back and Mimir off, and Mimir came back as a head. So there you go, spoilers, people. But Mimir isn't quite in the books, but because there's just so many Norse gods. But kind of like, speaking of kind of like how, of course, Frey has her own kind of like cedar magic in the I want to say canonical, but kind of like the set lore that we all know almost is well written and recorded about, kind of thing. It kind of also makes sense for her to have that kind of like prophetess, seeress type role. It really suited her, I thought. And as much as Frey has also talked about kind of like, oh, the goddess of beauty and love and sexual manifestations and all sorts, kind of thing, I always thought she must have some kind of maybe a dark streak to it, because otherwise why? I just think of her as like as a very strong woman trying to survive in a very male dominant planet, because a lot of the gods are gone. And as you mentioned, kind of like Snorri Sturluson, I'll always remember another favourite Norse creator of mine, Joanne Harris, went to a talk of hers at Barnsley Museum in my local neck of the woods in the UK. And I remember her saying that it's really unfortunate that Snorri seems to have written more stories about the male gods than the female gods. And there's probably a reason for that, whether he was intentional, because it seems not quite impossible, almost unfair, that there were lots of oral stories about the male gods and not equally enough oral stories about the female gods. Because the only female story we know about Freya is her love tryst with 12 doors to get the Brisingamen necklace, and that's about all we know. And of course Idun became an acorn and was taken off by Loki in a weird betrayal of the gods, then brought back again, and Sif had a haircut. They all seem to have like bad stories where they're the victims more than kind of like the heroes. Well, I say heroes in a very loose sense, because I remember reading one legend where it's just Thor and Odin disguised as a troll, and they're both on opposite sides of the river, and they're both having a swearing oath making match at each other, and there was no point to that legend at all. I didn't even find it funny. I thought it was rather manipulative of Odin to kind of like belittle one of his many sons in that manner. But the one thing that I definitely do want to ask you about, or at least kind of like elaborate my own thoughts and experience of, particularly in terms of The Strange Maid, is how well you've not just explored but expanded upon the role of the Valkyries in all this. Because they're some of the most minor characters in the pantheon, and so little is known about them besides a set of names and that they collect the dead. Their name means chooser of the slain, although it's always been interesting, I found, from all the other Norse fantasy books I've read, whether they choose the dead at the point of battle or they go and collect them after the person has died, kind of thing. So it's kind of like a before or after selection. And of course, they're the glorified beer maidens in Valhalla, bringing all the beer and ale and food around, kind of thing. But I really liked, and of course, as a fan of Valkyries, as just as a character of all sorts of secrets and mysteries, appreciated the way you've made them so active in the almost, I want to say, priestess-like role that they have in their set temples of sorts and shrines around the United States of Asgard, and their role with the dead, even though they're no longer invisible to mortal eyes. They're very visible now, because you don't see them just when you're dead, you see them when you're alive, because you can go and pray for your departed loved one in a shrine and have a Valkyrie bless you. I really, really loved that whole concept. It made so much sense, and especially kind of not just having them as individual priestesses, but also having them as a council. So they kind of like advise the human people, such as the president, but also kind of like advised Odin. Because one thing that's always struck me in particular from coming across the one Valkyrie we know of from the text, the Norse text, is the Volsung saga and Brynhilde, whether she's kind of like briefly mentioned as a Valkyrie for disobeying Odin, and thus she's been put on a bed and been waiting to be picked up by some fella who just happens to be Sigurd the Dragon Slayer, is whether they are really truly subservient to Odin, or whether they do have some of their own independent agency. And that's why I loved interviewing Kate Hatfield's previous episode. Dear viewers, go watch it after this one, of course, after this one, because her retelling is equally amazing and explores the world of the Valkyries equally in unique ways. I've never come across the same author, or different authors have Valkyries in the same way at all. They're all different, these aspects, but I just really appreciated yours. Just wanted you to know that.
Thank you.
I don't know how much you dived into the whole Valkyrie role and their personification, or what they did or what they didn't do, but I really, really liked your interpretation.
Oh, thank you. When I was still trying to get published for the first time, I was thinking about the Norse mythology and, you know, the war culture, all these things that I've already discussed about here, and Beowulf. And I started writing a historical retelling of Beowulf that followed Walkthiau's point of view from birth to death. And it was like this big epic thing. I ended up writing about 60,000 words of it, which only got to like right before Grendel was even going to show up. And the way that I was developing her was that's when I really dug into the like historical details and ancient ideas about what it might have been like actually living in Sweden in, you know, the year 400. And so I was thinking about what kind of roles priestesses might have. And in addition to the seething, the prophecy stuff, you know, you have the wandering prophets, I thought, well, obviously this is there has to be a death cult. most ancient cultures had some kind of death cult. And, you know, Odin and the Valkyrie are really ripe for that. And so that's really when I was making all these decisions about what I thought real human women in particular, like how might they have created the mythology of the Valkyrie, like as like servants of the gods, as avatars, even people who ride on wolves invisibly over a battlefield. What could be the real women who inspired that kind of thing? And so, you know, I was writing a whole book about Walkthiau, basically. And I put that down for a lot of reasons. And when it came time to really be working on the United States of Asgard trilogy, I knew I wanted the second book to be about a teenage Valkyrie, basically. And so I dragged up all of that stuff. And that's really why The Strange Maid is the book that it is, because I tried to write a retelling of Beowulf that took place during the time that Beowulf, if any of those things actually happened, probably would have happened around then, and made it modern. Like, what would a modern Valkyrie, what might her opinions be about the stories of Beowulf and Valkyrie from back then? And you mentioned the covenant already, the Thomas Jefferson riddled Odin. During the establishment of the United States of Asgard as a government and its own nation, and won, and that is why the gods have these rules about when they can and can't interfere and how they can and can't interfere with the destiny of the nation. And that is why the Council of Valkyrie exists in the United States of Asgard, because they are literally the go-betweens from the human government and the Asgardian government. It's not, you know, they're not really a government. Pantheon, I suppose. Mm. And so they do act as representatives from the humans to the gods and from the gods to the humans. So they really walk that line between divinity and mortality. And that is, there are supposed to be 9 of them scattered across, you know, there is the Valkyrie of the East and the Valkyrie of the West and the Valkyrie of the Lakes and the Valkyrie of the Rock and things like that. So I cannot remember what the actual question was anymore.
It was more just me fangirling about how wonderful I loved your interpretation of Valkyries and how you set them. But yes, I mean, to pick up on the point that you've made about how they do walk that line between mortality and divinity and there they go between, I think that's one theme that so many of the authors that I've written involving Valkyrie characters have picked up on, that they do often end up becoming almost like the bridge, if not the defender of humanity, very much like Thor in Marvel Comics. And he is, in a very heroic, dramatic, over-the-top sense, doing the same thing. But a lot of the Valkyrie protagonists I've come across are often trying to prevent the gods manipulating humans, doing something that's unfair to the humans, or if they witness a death that is wrong, they will then try and solve it or correct it or bring honor. They're often in between, but not quite, not always by default siding with the gods, even though stereotypically mention most people on a very low level know that it's Valkyries and then Odin, because of course it's Odin who gets the dead. Not many people realize that Freya gets half the dead. And I remember from my very, very, very young juvenile days as a wannabe writer, wannabe author, never did quite make it to J.K. Rowling level, but here I am, hey, it's not too bad. I wrote a very short flash fiction piece of Freya walking a battlefield with Odin, selecting her dead, and I made her quite dark and sinister in that she'd almost like lick the blood off a warrior and just kind of like put it on her tongue, almost like vampire-like. And that's why her
great.
Odin kind of like, were just, they have that, because they're almost too powerful beings in their own right, I think, because of course she has the cedar magic. Odin had to learn that from her. He didn't, all he had was the runes. So they both kind of have their own stance and their own plinth. And I've completely forgotten what I was going to say. But yes, I think you've matched what my own thinking and my own theories and my own experiences of, and of course my own idealistic view of Valkyries is that they are the bridge in between. And they can sometimes, in some cases, in a lot of fictional universes, as well as, of course, with Brunhild, choose to go against what the gods decree. And I really, really like that, because I remember being really struck, especially when I reread The Strange Maid, when Signy gets the idea, like, oh, Odin wants bloodletting. We need to give him like a blood eagle and a sacrifice and we'll do it without painkillers and he'll just die and it'll be glory and magnificent and Odin will be happy. And the other Valkyrie is like, whoa. Kind of like, we've agreed to keep everything PG at deaths now. We can't just do, we can't just do that anymore. Because remember what happened to Brynhild? She kind of like got banished. Even though I kind of like kind of mentioned her, but you don't actually mention what happens after she gets banished, which I was always curious about, whether there was a Sigurd the Dragon Slayer in your fictionalized alternative history of history. but then, of course, you, as I think I mentioned before, when your characters discuss the alternative civil war and it's Odin versus Thor and that one Valkyrie switches sides, Odin actually completely rewrites her name from the history. None of the humans remember what she was called, only the Valkyrie do. And I thought that was a nice nod to his treatment of Brunhild, and that he will stamp out disobedience with a tough boot. He'll just immediately crush it and kill it. And of course, Vikings of the time, honour and memory and being remembered was so central to everything that they do. I think even in the Havamal, it's about kind of like remembering, like, for so many years, but great deeds last forever, etc. Something along those lines, if you, is it? I'm not quoting it at all. It's been a while since I've even read the Havamal, and that's got a long list of verses. So one question which will possibly be a slight challenge for you, of course, forgive me for leaving this interview so long after I first read your books. I only got the courage to do this crazy YouTube thing last year. Is if you had to place yourself in your United States of Asgard, if it was real, or if it was just almost, think of it as a role-playing game, which path or type of destiny would you follow? Would you be a Loki's kin? Would you be a Freya worshipper? Would you be a Balder worshipper? Or would you just be... Because there were Christians, thankfully. It's a very inclusive world Tessa's got, I will say this.
Gosh, I don't know. I probably would have been, raised as a Thunderer, which is what, so the two biggest groups of people in the United States of Asgard worship Thor or Freyr. And it's not direct like comparison, but I've sort of set it up like Catholics versus Protestants kind of thing. So they're both basically, you know, worshiping the same ideals and like ultimately the same values theoretically, but coming at it from very different perspectives. And because I was raised Catholic, I'm saying I probably would have been raised as a Thunderer, because that's the more Catholic parallel, whereas the Freyans are more particularly Baptist, like Southern Baptist, very American form of Protestantism. And I definitely would not have stayed there, because Thor is very rigid in what he represents. And like, he represents a lot of things, but if you don't like the rules, then you aren't gonna be a very successful member of his congregations. And I am very much not a rule follower. So I wouldn't have lasted. I honestly don't know. And I would have had to pick, because that is one of the things in the United States of Asgard. In order to maintain your citizenship, you have to have an official god that you're dedicated to. I probably would have picked Loki, which would have just been a mess. But, you know, is very much the opposite of Thor and the rule following in a lot of ways. He's known in Asgard as the Changer. That's his nickname. So like Thor is Thunderer and Loki is the Changer. So I would have probably ended up with Loki. Yeah.
But Loki's kin definitely, and I love like the name Loki's kin. It just makes so much sense. They're very kind of like a transitional community. They never really stay in one place. They're often where you would find Bulbas and Seeresses. I remember in, I think it is The Lost Son, where Astrid does a kind of like a seeressing session for people to come and pay so they can get money. Because I think that's one thing that all three books have in common. Nearly all the characters go on quite a road trip around this alternative United States of America. And I would love to see the little maps you drew up to kind of like work out where they go next and hear their especially in The Strange Mage, when you've got more than one party.
That, you know, a great American road trip is a big part of American literature and storytelling. You know, the Western American mythology, the imperialist, I guess, is a way to say that too, is very much about movement, constant travel, going from one place to the next, looking at the horizon. You know, the Wild West, all of that is really baked into American popular culture. And so I really was determined that the three novels would each have road trip aspects.
Well, let us not forget The Apple Throne, because that was equally a very, very good book. I think I tried reading my reviews of it just to remind me what had happened, and I was so brief with the details. I didn't give away anything of the plot. I just said, this one trumps the other two. It is a worthy end of the trilogy. I wish there was more sad face. Because I do, and that's why I was kind of glad when you brought out The Weight of Stars, which is three novellas of the other characters that, of course, Sorin, Astrid and Signy meet. So would you mind just giving the viewers a little recap or overview of what the Apple Throne is about? Because that's Astrid's story more specifically.
It is hard to do without major spoilers for the first two books.
Think of it like a blurb.
Yes. So the Apple Throne is about Astrid, from who is the other main character in The Lost Son. It is about her when Soren goes missing. He just disappears from the world, as far as she can tell. And so she has to leave the place that she has been set by the gods, that she agreed to stay forever. And she has to basically defy the gods in order to seek Soren out. And Astrid is the one of the three of them who has always had the most faith and trust in the gods. And that when she's dedicated to Freya, and even though Freya has a really bad rap for, you know, being very manipulative and usually takes the hits when Odin is the one actually doing the manipulation, Freya takes the hits. But Astrid truly believes that Freya does what is best for the world, that she looks at all the strands of fate and plucks the ones that will make the world better. And so to go against Freya is really difficult for Astrid. And she meets new characters who are in various like pockets of not quite marginalization, but a little bit. And it's the first time you really meet a godling, a half god, half human character. He's a son of Thor and super not into his dad. And then another Thunderer who is dedicated, but has like secrets that if they came to light, he wouldn't be able to be dedicated to Thor anymore. So it is also a big road trip. And the best part is that I finally also get into the elves under the mountain and what life is like for them in North America, basically, how they got there and why they've been a secret. And, you know, people think in the United States of Asgard, humans think that elves are extinct, and that giants are extinct. And the only remnants of those kinds of inhuman peoples are the trolls who are throughout America, lots of different kinds of trolls. But yeah, so that's all an Apple Throne.
Well, it's the one book I never got around to rereading prior to the interview, and I do definitely want to reread it again just to make sure that my review stands the test of time. And I'm sure it will do, because your writing and the world is just brilliant. But speaking about the trolls and, of course, the elves and the other magical creatures in this amazing universe, I think it's the one feature that really enhances it, that brings it to life, that they kind of like go walking in the forest and you don't come across big brown grizzly bears, you come across trolls, but also kind of like cat whites and other small types of trolls. So there's almost like different species of them. It was quite diverse, and I kind of like loved how some of them could communicate, or some of them could be appeased by giving them silver or snacks or that kind of thing. And how did you do much research into what kind of creatures, I guess, the Norse might have believed in to then place in America, or did you just create a lot of them original?
I definitely did a lot of research. I love fairy tales also, of course. And so looking into the like fairies, and also, you know, this is something that I really appreciate from Tolkien's work in particular. Not his fiction, which is fine, but you know, he has done so much translation, and wrote academic essays about looking at the Old English in particular, like the Old English sagas and poems, as literature, as fairy tales, not just as, well, how can we mine this for historical facts. My favorite thing that Tolkien wrote that I have read is called The Monsters and the Critics. And it's an essay basically arguing that Beowulf is not a historic document. It's a living piece of literature. And when I read that, it just like really changed how I thought about literature in general and ancient literature and, you know, everything in between, about them as still being living things. You know, it's something that is really easy to think about when we're talking about something like Shakespeare, because, you know, we have different versions of his plays and, you know, the more popular ones, but those are constantly being reinterpreted. That's the point of theater, is to take words and perform them and interpret them through, you know, voice and set and costume. And so thinking about how we could do that with a poem like Beowulf, which of course translation itself is so changing, and there's so much interpretation. And even though technically Beowulf was written down in English, most modern readers can't read it directly. It has to be translated. Wow, this is a real tangent.
No, go for it. I'm all ears.
I really do love talking about Old English and language in general, and the English language and its history. But woof, what was I talking about? How did I go on this tangent?
We were talking about trolls. Oh, how you came up
trolls.
With
trolls. We were talking about trolls and Tolkien. That's what happened. It was really through that his work that I started looking into the different kinds of, you know, what details was he mining to come up with his dwarves and his elves and things like that? And what are the other versions of those that are old and show up in poems and hints and things like that? And there's even some of it in Old English. Like the word elf comes from like Old English, and then before that, a Norse word. I can't remember the exact tree. So it was really all that research, and I knew I wanted the trolls to be varied, like cats is really how I was thinking about them. And, you know, you've got little house cats all the way up to lions and everything in between. You know, we've got, you know, bobcats and panthers and tigers and cheetahs and all these different kinds that are still recognizable as cats. But the behaviors are just, you know, where they live and how they've evolved and that kind of thing. So I wanted to play with how the fundamental aspects of how I understand trolls from the older Norse fairy tales and mythology, like how might they have evolved both in a like natural biological way, and also how could different forms of magic have pushed some in one direction and others in another direction. So that's really what I came up with. I think there are 7 main branches of trolls: the iron wights, cat wights, prairie trolls,
mountain trolls,
and mountain trolls. Maybe there's just 5. Am I missing one? That might be the basics, those 5 ones. And of course the cat whites and iron whites are the smallest and the most mischievous, and the mountain trolls are the biggest and also the most intelligent, and they have the most magic that affects them. And the troll mothers are directly connected to the elves through magic. So,
well, I just
anymore would be a spoiler.
Oh no, there's so much rich detail you've created in across all these stories, Tessa. And I kind of like, after I finished the last short story in The Weight of Stars, I was thinking, There needs to be a world of the United States of Asgard encyclopedic book, just so I can just dive into this world and never leave it, because it's just so rich and I just absolutely loved it. And I'm so pleased I can get to tell you face to face that I do. I really, really, really love it. It's if very few friends that ever. Most of my friends are so different to me. None of them are really into all this stuff. But when they, if I ever meet anyone who does, I just immediately recommend it. I really, really do. I guess the last question I'd like to ask is, kind of like following on writing these books, did your interest with Norse mythology kind of remain? Did it fade? Did you come across any other interests or influences along the same lines? It's okay if not. We hold no grudges here.
This is actually, I put down Norse mythology and, you know, the United States of Asgard very hard and abruptly and on purpose, because the experience of publishing them was very upsetting.
Sorry to hear that.
The Lost Son was my third published book. And when I sold it, I sold it to Random House Children's Books. And I had a great experience there with my first two novels, Blood Magic and The Blood Keeper, which are, they're about folk magic. And I mean, very, very bloody folk magic, young adult novels. And as we were finishing editing The Lost Son and starting to do like the package, like where the cover would be, as that happened, Random House and Penguin merged. And so it became Penguin Random House. And there was a lot of upheaval and a lot of changes in how, like, the direction of the imprint that I was at, and editors leaving and new editors coming, and just lots of rearranging the bureaucracy of merging two giant publishers. And The Lost Son really was affected poorly from that. I lost my editor, so I didn't have an in-house advocate for the book in the same way. And some of the direction changed, and we went from having what, you know, I consider to be a really dynamic, beautiful fantasy cover to something that is a very paranormal YA design. I don't think, you know, so just a lot of little things happened, and I was, you know, writing The Strange Maid at the same time, and The Strange Maid is a very fraught book. It was very difficult to write. It's just, there's so much going on, and I was going through a lot. And then right after The Strange Maid published in, I think, June of 2014, so almost a decade ago, my agent called me, and I thought we were going to be talking about my next series after The Apple Throne. And instead, she was calling to tell me that the publisher was canceling publication of The Apple Throne. And so I was, you know, distraught. You know, it's something that does happen pretty regularly in publishing, but of course, it didn't ever happen to me.
I know.
And so I was really, really upset about it. And if The Apple Throne hadn't already been essentially done, I don't know if I would have published it on my own, because I was just very upset. And so once I will say the publisher was very good to me, you know, with regards to, you know, they canceled the series, but they gave me back all the rights and everything was very friendly. I really enjoyed the people that I was working with at that time. But I was just exhausted and upset, and, you know, all my dreams of this series, which everyone that I had talked to who had read it or that I pitched it to really was excited about the ideas. And so it just felt like and it sort of felt like being left at the altar is what I said at the time. And so once I republished them, like I self-published the trilogy and then added The Weight of Stars, I was like, this has to be on a shelf over there. I'm not going to think about it anymore. And I took all of my old English books and my Norse books and I put them in a different, like they're still on a shelf, but yeah, not in my office. So it was a really like hard drop of that. And then I did my best to ignore all of that for several years while I focused
until I came along and brought it all back.
So I really can't say what it that anything spooled directly from it, though. The next book that I wrote and sold was The Queens of Innes Lear, which is a fantasy feminist retelling of King Lear, and a lot of my research that I had done definitely like backdoored into, you know, how I invented my ancient, it's basically Ireland. So
that's fine.
Well,
so I am truly sorry you've had such a tough experience from publishing these three, because who knows what could have happened if things were different. But I still appreciate you carrying on with it, even to the most bitter of endings, to just get the books out there, get them read, because I think they certainly make a whole, they do. All three novels, and of course the short stories is kind of like extra bonus features around the edge, and I really, really appreciate them. They're always on my favourite shelf, which is always fun. That's why I'm always having to rearrange my books.
It definitely changed me as a writer. When I reread the main trilogy before this, because I couldn't remember like anybody's names.
Don't worry about it. No. Most people who are readers read that many books. I'm surprised we remember anything.
Yeah, exactly. So I reread them, and the difference to me in The Lost Son to The Strange Maid, I feel like as a writer, I leveled up multiple levels. Mm-hmm. In the writing, like The Lost Son, I think, you know, the story is great. I love the characters in the world, but I can see looking back after 10 years, I'm like, oh, well, this is a little clunky. I would finesse this part now. But when I read The Strange Maid, I had the opposite reaction. I wouldn't change a word of The Strange Maid, even 10 years later. And the difference as a writer is it's such an interesting lesson that, you know, everything that I was going through career-wise and everything I was trying to do ambition-wise was worth it. Like so this series really will always have a very important place in my heart. And because of your invitation to be on this podcast, I was reflecting on the fact that it has been 10 years. And so this is a good time to tell anyone who's listening that at the end of May, I'm actually going to be taking them all down. So if you want to read them now, you should get them.
Okay, right. You've heard it here first, viewers. Go buy, go download, go borrow from your local library, make sure they got them in.
Yep. I'm going to take them down and then re-jacket them, like totally do like a new modern take. I'll probably revise The Lost Son a little bit, but not The Strange Maid. And hopefully, I think you'll be excited to hear write some new content. So it won't be, I'm looking at the 15th anniversary as my goal for all of that, because I have a lot going on right now, which will be 2028, but that's my goal right now. So get it while you can.
That's
and then otherwise
I'll put some money in the jar, ready and waiting to buy when it comes out. Oh, well, I'm so pleased that it's not been too much of a traumatic reflection, given now that we know kind of like the publishing world is tough. And yes. I know from my mere experience just doing creative writing as a degree that just writing is the hardest part. And then the publishing bit is equally hard. And it does take more than one person to publish a book because it's a lot of stuff. There's a lot to think about and do. And I will reiterate thank you for continuing with the series, even after your Penguin Random House murder experience. Unfortunately, that's... So thank you. And of course, it's really exciting that this whole experience of rereading and of course coming to talk to little old me has encouraged you to go forth and bring them back anew, even bigger and better than before, because they can only ever get better, Tessa, because they're already good. And I completely agree with you with The Strange Mate, because the intensity of emotion and in characters, because I think it's because it's so Signy focused. Signy is such the driving force. Mm-hmm. When the first one, there's like three protagonists all vying for the same thing. Yes, it's a whole other level, but that just shows the passion that you had when you were writing it, and I thank you for it. And
I hope so. Thank you.
I thank you for your wonderful time and the wonderful little surprise announcement, which I did not know was coming, of course, viewers. Yeah. It was a genuine surprise to me, and I am very, very excited. So yes, thank you so much for your time, and I wish you luck with all your writing projects, not just, of course,
redoing
the United States of Asgard, which I think is a country we should all visit, even with the trolls and the cat whites.
Well, it's a mess, but that's because I base it on the United States of America, which is also a mess.
Well, thank you very much again, and thank you to you, dear viewers and listeners, viewing and listening. As you said, Tessa Heard, she's taking down these current versions of the quartet, as I will now call them. So please do go borrow and draw them. Otherwise, mark it in your diary for 2028. Hopeful new versions with new content. And I will be emailing Tessa at 2028 to ask, is it done yet?
Definitely. Well, if you want to keep up to date, you can go to my website, which is tessagratton.com, and sign up for my newsletter.
Oh, yes.
And that's where all these kinds of announcements go out first. And I talk about all of my books and writing and frequently write essays about things. Go do that, tessagratton.com.
Brilliant. And are you on any social platforms of any particular that you would like people to join and follow you?
I am primarily on Instagram these days. That's where I do the most. I'm also technically on Twitter, but I don't like it there anymore. Yeah. So mostly I'm just there to look at fan art and keep up with Star Wars readers.
That's fine. Well, as you said, dear viewers, go to tessagratton.com. Feel free to follow on Instagram, but no pressure to do so. Yeah. And we'll all be downloading the newsletter and keeping track for the next couple of years. Thank you again so much for your time in this wonderful sixth episode of Valkyries. I just keep thinking Valkyries. Valhalla Conversations. When I can get my own YouTube series name right, it'll be a good day. And thank you everyone for watching and listening. Enjoy the rest of your day. Goodbye.